This is a digital recording of the Academic Senate meeting of March 8th, 2012.
Anya Bergman from Marissa Pigpen and Susan Moulton for Matthew Carlos Callahan. Thank you all for stepping in. Run through a few items for my report first. As you probably heard, the Provost is charged in the Senate Budget Subcommittee, augmented by a couple of department chairs, to work on developing budgeting principles for academic affairs, and the committee is trying to work out exactly what that means, and trying to do that is trying to hold some broader conversations. So I think the social sciences, is a couple of department chairs, is already having conversations, giving us some good feedback, and on the agenda of the science and tech department chair. So we're trying to have some broader conversations about what that might look like, to have some principles that could guide budgeting decisions other than expediency. So if you have ideas for that discussion, let me know, or your budget committee representative. And expect to be hearing more about those discussions. The Reed Music Center Board of Advisors meets tomorrow, and on the agenda for that is a proposal from the University Affairs Subcommittee, which is composed primarily of faculty, proposing that the Board of Advisors put on the fundraising agenda for the Music Center substantial endowment to support considerable support to the music and theater and dance programs. And so that conversation has been developed by the School of Arts and Humanities and various faculty, and was endorsed by the University Affairs Committee. And we'll see how that goes at the Board of Advisors tomorrow. Over the fall semester and continuing, we've been having a series of conversations among the faculty and in various forums about SSU's academic identity and what we want that to be going forward. And I told you in the fall about a grant that University Affairs and Development Division had received to bring an outside consultant to work on what the outward facing piece of that identity might be. Committee has been interviewing marketing consultants for the last couple of days. The last finalist finished about 45 minutes ago, and so hopefully over the course of the spring we'll have some focus groups and interviews happening on campus to help start crafting an external picture to the world about the university built on ideas growing out of faculty and student conversations. Finally, unfortunately, this Monday, I originally had scheduled one of those lunches. We're going to cancel that because both the provost and I want to be able to attend the talk on remediation that's happening at noon on Monday. So I hope that all of you will try to attend that session. It's called Remediation as a Civil Right at the CSU, right? And that event's in Schultz 3001 at noon. So that means that the next lunch for us will be in the Faculty Center on Friday, March 23rd. All right, so I think that's it for the items I wanted to mention. Any questions for me?
Just to clarify, the President Arminiano's letter on the budget said that the Provost Finance Committee or Budget Committee was going to be working on it, but he actually, I believe, was referring to the Senate Budget Subcommittee as augmented with two department chairs.
That's my understanding of what he meant by that, yes. More questions for me? Okay. So, agenda. Additions or changes. This is item number two. A guest has asked to be present for that, so I've given business item number two a time certain of 3:40. Any other requests for time certain for reports or anything else? Okay, any objections to approving the agenda? Seeing none, that's approved. So minutes of February 23rd were emailed to you. Any comments, corrections, changes? Senator Rand.
I said, about to the law.
it was true. Unfortunately, it was. So, yes, I think other than the parenthetical remarks of herself about whether this is the funny, any other corrections to the minutes? Okay, any objections to approving them? None, that's done. Since people have been wondering, the election closed this morning at 8, the candidates' elections, and since we're trying to notify the candidates before we announce publicly the winners of the election, we're going to wait till tomorrow morning and send out via email the winners of the election. We have the sheriff's department hasn't been able to contact all the candidates yet. But we still need 38 votes to reach the 50% turnout for the constitutional amendment. Votes are in the Congress. We decided we're going to extend 1 week at a time. 50%, but let's make it just one extension. If you haven't voted, do. If your neighbor hasn't, get him or her to vote. There's that number's going down, but the rate of decrease is decreasing. Yeah. All right. Let's see. So I've not received any correspondence to speak of, and so I think we'll go on to the first business item. So, members, I have.
All right. So as we discussed last time, the main issue is that the main reason this originally came forward was because the calendar changes, and so we were trying to take the specific dates out of the policy and indicate that they will be posted at the end of the prior academic year or the following year so that people would have plenty of time to submit. The only substantive change really is that we're recommending to remove the practice of automatically moving forward the candidates from a prior year into the next year. And as I said last time, this was originally proposed with the idea that it might actually reduce work and not having to necessarily keep vetting things again and calling and all that. But what we've discovered is it actually created more work because of all the confusion that it was causing, and it just seemed to be simpler to just go back to a system where the packages will be submitted each year, and then when they were done with them, they would send the portfolio back to the candidate. Or the nominee, so they could use those materials again if they wish. So I guess that's basically my intro. There's any questions I'm happy to hear.
Great. So this is a second reading. Amendments are in order. Changes.
I just wanted to kind of share my experience. I really enjoyed having the two-year cycle. I think that my first year of being nominated, I didn't quite get the process down, and I was actually quite happy to be able to revise my packet for the second year, and I found that to be a useful thing. So if I don't vote for this, it would be because I think that having 2 years is a good idea. I don't know if it's worth having an amendment to actually separate these two things or have an amendment that takes that part out. I haven't decided that, but I just wanted to share that I actually did like quite a lot having those 2 years.
Other comments? Not seeing any. I think we're ready to vote. All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? That carries. Abstentions? Wish to four and abstentions? Four abstentions. All right, so that carries the four abstentions. No, thank you. That worked out fast. Let's see, President Armagnac is in Long Beach today, meeting with the other presidents. Provost Armagnac? Provost Rogerson.
That's the funny thing.
We're spending 6 hours of meetings with
him. Just give him the salad. Okay, I guess everyone here has heard about the phenomenal success of the School of Education, passing both. I was at the meeting, I talked to the commissions beforehand, and they got 10 gold stars, which is about as high as you could ever hope to get. So if you're still feeling sobering up and coming down, congratulations. Wonderful. Nice piece of news. I have here something about our Moodle upgrade, just to draw your attention to it. University, we go through an upgrade from version 1.9 to 2.2. We had an email about this, so please look out for training sessions that are coming up about Moodle. And then Bernard, anyone that doesn't know what I'm talking about, I'll let you read this rather than me reading it out. The university is continuing to support the LSM program, and Sam Brennan will take the lead again as coordinator over into another grant cycle of 5 years, I imagine, so that's rather nice that we're committed to continue that initiative. And finally, we're not absolutely certain on how this will look, but we are proposing to put in a cap on enrollment in the coming fall. We're looking at either 12 units as the first pass, or maybe 14 units, and then a cap of 16 for undergraduates. It would be a flexible policy, if you like, on petitioning, because we know a lot of graduating seniors would need more than 16, and the graduate students would be allowed to go to 18 to accommodate the education students. So the slight unknown in this is after we've made this brave decision to kind of go public with this, then I had a meeting with Ephraim Smith in the Chancellor's office, and the provost meeting next week, the whole issue of caps is coming up. It seems that a lot of campuses are putting in caps, and it's causing a little bit of distress. So at the moment, we are proposing a maximum of 16, but that might all change after the provost meeting next week, and we might be in a little bit of a problem. But stay tuned, and for this official, I'll announce that. So I want the message to get out to the students early so that they can start planning well ahead of time how they're going to progress through the next year.
All right,
so
So regarding those caps, is the word coming down from the Chancellor's office for the issue of if there's a cap at the end of registration overall, or are they wanting to interfere even with the cycles of trying to give people access?
I'm not sure. I only know because I'm on the committee that sets the agenda for the provost meeting, and this was something Ephraim brought up that's causing a lot of concern on campuses. A lot of campuses are putting in caps, and it's all the different amounts. So it seems like it's all over the place, which is something the CSU doesn't always like. San Jose, I believe, are capping at 15. So there's a little bit of concern, and that will be a discussion item next week. So hopefully we'll be able to be there.
Thank you. Senator Shannon.
We've had the habit of stepping up, and we tried last registration, I think 9 units, then 12 units, the next step, and then 16. I understand the next plan is to do all more of just 12 at Reg 1, or...
Okay. Yeah, that's right. 12 at Reg 1, and then step right up to 16. But we're also flexible. We're hearing, we're taking input, so I mean, again, maybe not here, but over the next week, if you feel this is a problem, a huge problem, have a discussion with us. We've already had concern from, I think it was the EOP students, was it?
There was an issue raised about EOP students.
EOPs might need 14, so we may have to think 14, then 16. It's a little bit fluid. I just want everyone to know that we are trying to impose a cap, and that's our initial thinking.
And my concern was really, or my question was really more overall, this may work beautifully, but I know when we tried the step up in 3 tiers, I was seeing fewer situations of seniors with juniors, people with 20, and people with 3 units. And so as we look at this, I hope we'll just monitor it to see how those are faring who come near the end of registration.
Yeah, that's exactly what we'll do, and we'll use the wait list again. We'll be allowed to register for 8 units on wait list, and that will let us gauge very nicely where the problem areas are, and we just have to micromanage it. We are in the unfortunate or fortunate position of bringing in large enrollments again, and so we have to manage it. But I have to say, you know, just the spring was painful, but we actually got everyone to the classic beneath. But we would rather not repeat that exercise. That was a little bit too much rounding back. So the idea is of a balanced fall and a balanced spring was less pain for everybody.
Senator Watt.
Just a tiny bit of feedback, even though you said no feedback now. Sir, I've been seeing in my advising more and more students who are interested in double majoring or at least minoring. And certainly the more we have caps coming down, it makes that virtually impossible. So it just, and those are often my best students, and I'm like, you know, I hate to tell them, no, you can't learn more. So it's a concern on my end.
I would like to think as we embark on this, in some ways, changing the philosophy on campus, that the freshmen will be given a limit of 16 units. So they're going to come in with the expectation that this is normal, 5 classes a semester is a good path to the SSU. But I realize to try and force this on ongoing students is going to be a little problematic. So I think we are looking at a lot of exceptions as we move through. But you know, the reason we thought 16 is because the message we're giving freshmen is 15 or 16 units is a full load. And to then have 18 for everybody else, just we need to be consistent. But we can be flexible.
Senator Vogel.
Yes. What about students who want to add a 5-unit language class in the second round? Where would they petition, and may that petition then be turned down? Or is that, would you say that would be supported?
I'm sorry. I didn't quite hear what you were asking.
Yeah, I'm wondering about those students who want, you know, once they've registered for 12 units, and then they want to add a 5-unit language class, because all our language classes in the first and second year have carried 5 units. So they would have to petition in this scenario. So that and that would be quite a number of people. Will they have a chance, or is this a...
Probably that concern is one that you should probably send to us, because as we talk about what's the right maximum, we're not always aware of issues around, you know, of course, that's 5 units versus 4 units.
Okay.
So maybe the answer is 17. Maybe the answer is 16. We need to know that. In that particular instance, though, if it happens 16, the student should be advised to sign up for the language course first, and then add in the remaining courses together to 16.
Right. Although that is a problem, of course, for, again, we have lots of students who are double majoring, and then in the case of German, it's just a minor program, so clearly, you know, other classes take priority usually. But thank you.
Yes, Vice President Rainey.
Has there been any further conversation about moving to a course cap, or somehow being able to kind of make an exception for those lab courses that were brought up? I know languages do, most upper division classes, language courses and science courses are 4 with the lab. So that 5-unit course, essentially, for students makes it incredibly awkward to find a number that fits. You're talking about 3, 4, or 5-unit courses.
The issue around that is actually an issue with our registration system, because it works on the basis of units and not number of courses. I think there's a programming problem there, but it's certainly something we could take to the to the CMS staff and see if it could work.
Thanks, Senator Ram. Thank you. I know I've mentioned this before, but I think a lot of these problems could be solved if, instead of having a cap, you have a line that once you cross that line, you can't add the units. So that once a student adds beyond 15, then they have to stop. So whether they add 17, whether that's 16, whether that's 18, once they cross the line, then they're done, and then we wouldn't have to make a special case.
Taking that one over, just kind of wouldn't.
I'm not sure this is the right place to put this, but I'm going to sneak it in. Totally change subject. I want to thank you for the support that you've been giving faculty development. I went to the first of a series with Matthew and other people in this room did. It was one of the most outstanding things that I have gone to at Sonoma State. So thank you very much. And I encourage everybody who's giving another session on March 20th.
Yes, Representative Coquino.
Thank you. The other thing I would like to do is thank the provost for coming yesterday to the People's University event. He was out there along with Larry Slareth was there also, Neil Markley, earlier in the morning, and the provost stayed with us for at least a good hour, if not more, talked with students about concerns with all kinds of other things. So thank you. And who else was it?
The faculty.
Oh, yes. And Dr. Ford was there also, and the other faculty members, but in particular the provost, simply because he was giving his report to my father.
I'm gonna file on that. I should have mentioned in my report the Faculty Research Expo yesterday, which is the sponsored programs committee, and the girl all did such an outstanding job in putting on. And Rose Rogerson expressed a lot of support for scholarship and research there as well. It was a great event, so I really want to encourage you to come every year. Anything else with Provost? Okay. Chair Purser, I had forgotten that we had asked her to do a more extensive budget committee report, so I stepped on her toes and gave my report, and she's going to give a more extensive one.
This is the extended play version of the budget committee. Thank you. I wanted to report to you, at least at the very, what feels like for us in the committee, the very beginning of this process. But as you heard Chair Ford say, this was set in motion several weeks ago, and it took us a while to get the committee augmented. We put out a call for department chairs who would be willing to serve on it, and got two, and that's been great. And we've also just started to get feedback in, or consultation feedback in, from the first sets of school-level councils of department chairs. We've got social science within, and I understand we should be hearing back from science and technology very soon. And then on this Tuesday, we also got a request from associated students that we add their body to the list of constituencies on campus that we consult with. So we're really just starting to get some feedback in from people. And so this report is going to sound very preliminary, but it seemed like a good idea to let you know what's going on, and then open the floor for questions here briefly if you've got the time to do it. So first and foremost, this was something that it grew out of a conversation in the academic coordinating team where both the provost and the faculty chair were talking about where one might situate a conversation about budgeting principles. As the next year rolls forward. And in large part, I think it was an attempt to sidestep to the extent that it's possible the fact that everything that's going on with the budget is a moving target. We're not going to know until May the 5th, and we're not going to know until November, and we're not really going to know until January. And it makes it excruciatingly difficult to plan, and it only increases everyone's sense of chaos. And so where would you put a conversation that would begin to lay out some principles for how to make decisions, both in the short term and then more importantly and more effectively, really, because of the time frame we're talking about here, longer term decision-making processes. So first and foremost, this is a committee that will ultimately come up with something that will resemble a list of principles. That's not a list of priorities, and I know that sounds like wordsmithing, but it is a different kind of thing. So this is not a committee that's going to be ranking anything or anyone, or would they conceivably have the authority to do so, and if we might like to do so, we cannot do so. And nobody on the committee that I've talked to has any stomach for doing that. Secondly, it's really grounded in academic affairs and faculty governance. But that doesn't mean we're not looking broadly at the university as a whole. In fact, one of the things that came out of the first sets of meetings was realizing we really do have kind of scales at which people all across campus have already started contributing really good ideas. Some of them are, in fact, university-wide. Some of them relate specifically to sort of academic affairs and the academic mission. And some of them are very specific to schools and even departments, because we're not one-size-fits-all entities at a school and department level, and what works in one area may or may not work in others. So it's very much a sort of scale or process, which is why we need to do as much consulting as possible with as many different constituencies as possible. And that's what our agenda is at this point, is talking to as many different groups as we possibly can, and we're having members of the committee go out and ask the council, department chair, and school of social sciences, for example, to have a conversation themselves about what they would consider useful principles for guiding budget-making decisions. So we started doing that, and last but not least, what came up the last meeting and was further discussed a bit in XCOM last week is the idea of having campus-wide conversations, whether we're going to call them town halls or just open forums or discussions, in part to get some good ideas and also in part to make sure that the information that is available about what the heck is going on is as broadly distributed and as transparent as possible. And because it is such a moving target, that can be very hard to do. We all know the way that rumors can spread like wildfire in any institution, and they're no different. So be looking for some notices and some emails about as many different kinds of just open forums and conversations as we might be able to get going between now and the end of the semester. And then if anybody's got any questions that I can answer, I'll be happy to.
Okay, Senator, I was wondering if there's been any thought about doing kind of a campus-wide survey. I know you said you're not dealing with priorities, you're dealing with principles, but it seems like priorities guide principles, and not that, you know, your committee isn't well informed by its constituents, but I think having data from a survey would be really helpful. So is there any thought about doing a campus-wide survey of the faculty to try to narrow down priorities?
There will be now. I'm not sure it would be framed around priorities, but I can certainly, in other words, the kind of language of material that's coming into us are things like, we really ought to incentivize cost saving around here by making sure that when people save money, the money they save gets to stay in their unit. That's a principle, it's not a priority. You see what I mean? So, those are the kinds of things that we actually find the most helpful, because they in fact do help make decisions, and they do become things that we can lobby for and push for as policy. If that makes any sense. But I love the idea of a survey. I mean, I think that's great, and I'll take that back.
It makes it so easy.
Senator
Bates. Is there going to be staff representation on this committee?
There is a staff representation, but one of my questions to you is going to be coming out of staff council. Well, there's going to come in.
We don't have a staff council.
Yeah.
What? There is no staff council.
There is a, I thought there was a staff council.
There's a union, yeah. But as far as the directive from Larry Schlereth was that the union has stated that it's a conflict of interest to have a staff council and the union.
So maybe you and I can have a conversation about the most effective way we can help with that, whether it's at the school level or whether it be across, again, thinking primarily in terms of academic affairs, but probably how it
could. I don't mind everybody, keep your voices up. Are you hearing your Senator Hall?
In the past, we've had a director of institutional research, and that position's not now filled. And in order to dispel some of the rumors and whatnot, APC this morning we talked with the provost about reviving or expanding a kind of statistical dashboard so information could be made available either on the website with your committee or on the Senate website or maybe on the main website with basic facts about what's our enrollment, how many faculty do we have, what's our budget, what percent goes to academic affairs and other things and all of that. So transparency could exist and
many of those people in the campus that may not be in the center or on committees can look at it and make observations or suggestions.
I think that would be brilliant. In fact, if I could get that was up before we started doing surveys, so that people can touch and get into it.
I might curious about the what role the Senate Budget Committee is playing in this, if any.
This is the Senate Budget Committee.
Okay.
So we're playing the whole role. From Diva right on down.
Thank you.
Any more for Sarah for sir? All right. We'll move on. It's just a few minutes till our first time serving, and the person who had asked to know what time that's going to happen, he is here, so unless there's objection, I want to move to business item two. All right, let's go for it. So this is a first reading on a new sabbatical and vacation pay policy, which Senator Senkhase introduced.
So you have a memo in your packet that's giving much of background. And this has been something a long time coming, and we've been working closely with URTPS, the University Reappointment, Tenure, and Promotion Subcommittee, as well as in consultation with the CFA as we've gone through this. And it's actually been going over some months, but it's drawn on actually some years of experience of seeing that we have trouble with workflow in terms of processing sabbaticals and VIPs. And when we started chasing down why we were having recurring problems, we discovered that basically it comes down to there are two different CBA articles, 27 and 28, deal with sabbatical leaves and difference in pay, different leaves, respectively. And we were trying to solve both with one policy. And the mind meld wasn't complete. So what we figured we would do is, instead of trying to rewrite the single policy, put it aside and start with two new, much clearer, much simpler policies that would each address all the issues in each of the respective articles. So that's why there's a sabbatical leave policy and a difference in pay leave policy. And this, by doing this, it's much easier to stay consistent with the CBA articles. And also what we discovered as we were looking at the CBA articles is that the levels of review and process needed to be different because actually those were stipulated in the CBA differently. Because sabbaticals are coming from a central pool, they have to basically compete with each other and be ranked. And because difference in pay leaves don't involve that, they don't have to go through a central pool and be ranked against each other. They just seem to be, are they an opportunity that could be met or not? And so that's why you'll see a slight difference in the two policies. So what's come forward, we think, is going to help deal with the process issues. As I said last time, we're not going into the criteria of evaluation of merit. We think that's a separate argument, and if people want to have it, it may very well warrant a discussion. But we're not trying to solve the criteria of merit in here. We're trying to get us in compliance with the collective bargaining agreement. And so each of these will do that. So we now see clear paths through, and these are listed in the advantages. Another thing that we were able to do by setting these policies up as simpler and clearer is identify where were the points where we could have transparency in the process, and that would lead us to the accountability. A complaint that we've heard about, and there's evidence supporting it, there have been times when sabbaticals might have been granted, and a department let a faculty member go, and the resources were not provided to the department to backfill all the person's absence. And so this process makes it a little clearer where and when that's happening. We've also had instances where people were granted or would have been granted a leave because they ranked high enough, but they were too essential. And so we also wanted to be able to flesh out those conditions so that that person wouldn't be perpetually excluded from sabbaticals for logistical reasons, right? You're too good for us to let you go. It's back to what principles do we want to have, you know? And so we were trying to solve that as well. So the processes will do that. We also think, and I hope you agree, if you look at our policies and look at the prior policies, they are a little bit simpler to follow. And we've intentionally framed them in as parallel structure as possible, only differing where the CBAs point us in slightly different directions. But especially in terms of where to look at the sabbaticals and definitions and all that, we try to keep them there. And then finally, in the process, we also see an opportunity for a reduction in some faculty workload, faculty and staff workload, as we look at the sabbatical review levels. So after all this, we've come forward with the recommendation that to meet the collective bargaining Article 27 criteria, what they refer to as a professional leave committee, we use a committee that we already have and we're familiar with and has already been dealing with these things. A professional leave committee would be identified as the University Reappointment and Promotion Subcommittee. And they'll be the ones that would be ranking sabbatical applications. We also are recommending that there be two separate processes for applying for the respective grants. And this is because in the current practice of saying, I'm going to file for a sabbatical, and if I don't get it, I want to pick a debt. The problem is by the time that the sabbatical is denied and you are discovering that you have to go into a debt process, the department may have already obligated itself because scheduling will have moved so far along, and so that produces a problem. And so what we're wanting to do is, if you're wanting to be applying for both, just put in the two applications and run them through the process. If you're only wanting to do one, then you can just do one, but keep them separate, because going into the DIP process after the sabbatical is done doesn't work from the departmental levels. So third, we're recommending that the appropriate administrator, as identified in both Articles 27 and 28, be the school and library deans, because that's what we're doing anyway, and we just thought let's have the policy reflect what we're actually doing. And by specifying it as being there, it also increases the transparency and accountability as to where the allocation of resources. This is addressing part of that issue of two departments get properly backfilled when the money comes into the school. Item four on page two, Roman numeral four. We also wanted to identify the provost as the president's delegated individual for making the final decisions on the sabbaticals and dip leaves. Because for a very similar reason that we were specifying with the deans, the provost is the one who's actually allocating the money back and forth across the schools and the library. And so that is the sensible role to have in this place, because then it brings a transparency there. It's been brought to our attention that why should we take this away from the president? But actually, I did run the policy by both president and the provost, and there didn't seem to be objections. I'm assuming if the president objects, he just wouldn't approve of the policy. But this makes sense because this also keeps it visible from the provost's perspective as the deans are making these kinds of decisions. And of course, a delegated authority, well, if President Armignano wanted to, overrule that, he doesn't lose his authority when it's delegated. But it just seemed like a name it in the policy. It's easier, especially if we have, in years to come, different people coming through, the local practice will be clear and they'll have a lot there. And then finally, in Roman numeral 5, we are recommending that the current practice of having the departments and schools do a level of review for merit before it goes to URTPS, that we consider taking this out of the process. And the reason we do this is after consultation with URTPS, we're finding that the departments don't have the view of the pool. They are only seeing what's in their department. And so that's really where why the URTPS is even doing the evaluation on the sabbatical side rather than the departments. So what we're finding is if you consider that there's three criteria going into the ranking. One is years of service. Another is years since you've been of, or not years, the amount of service somebody's been putting in, and the years that the how long the individual has been able to go for a sabbatical. Right? Those two factors actually count up for more weight than the merit. And so we were finding that the amount of effort of those two levels of review, two sets of committees having to look in, we're only getting a marginal input at the URTPS level. And given all that work, and in the current climate where we're constantly saying, why do we have so much work? Here's one where we feel like there's enough check, we've got faculty in there. The application should be able to speak to somebody out of the discipline, since it is competing across disciplines, right? So it should be accessible from the outside, much as the NSF or NIH type grants are. That was enough, and here's a chance to lose some work. So, but still keeping faculty in there. And so I guess that's my basic introduction.
So I'm going to remind you, this is the first reading, so major objections, suggestions for improvements, that kind of thing, are in order. I'm going to hand the gavel to the person that I want to get on the speaker's list for this one.
So, Senator Brandon, the first one.
Yes, thank you. I understand the rationale for most of these changes. I do have a problem with one of them, however. So it seems like the motivation for these changes was to be consistent with the collective bargaining agreement. And in the collective bargaining agreement, it says that the president is identified as making the final decision regarding some benefits of the DMPs. And yet, it seems like you want to put into the policy that it would be the provost, whereas it seems like if the president wanted to delegate the provost in that position, and if the current president and current provost agree to that, then that would be fine. But there will come a day when we have another president who may not agree to it. So I don't know if we want to codify who that designee would be, because the future president may not agree. And it just seems unnecessary to, especially if we're trying to make a go with the CBA, to actually make it seem like go against the CBA by trying to delegate authority ourselves that belongs to the president. So when it comes to a second reading, I would probably move to change that.
I wanted to address the recommendation to remove the department and school level review for sabbatical merit. And I mentioned this at the faculty research expo yesterday, that one of the things I value about my research community is that my research is validated by people in my discipline who know my discipline are qualified to be evaluated. And I'm concerned that when we're talking about research applications, I'm not comfortable sending it off to a committee which might include nobody in a discipline even remotely close to mine. I really feel that my application would be disadvantaged compared to those coming from people whose disciplines are represented on the committee if there's no provision for a statement from the department. So I really would rather see a really brief statement from a department committee on the merit. I realize it's less than half of the percentage weighting, but I think we could make it, you know, easy enough to do that. And, you know, one page statement from the department that feeds into the URTPS.
Thanks. Senator Roberts?
Thank you. Two things. I just want to reiterate something that Senator Brennan said, and typically if we want a designee other than the president, that's all you need to say in parentheses, president or designee. And that way, if the president, whoever they are at any given time, wants to say, well, now it's going to be the provost, it's quick and dirty, and you don't have to go back and revise the policy. The other thing is, I think to strengthen this a little bit, on page 2 of the DIP, on 5.1, is actually from the collective bargaining unit. The words are a little different. I mean, it's not completely plagiarized, but I think it would help to be stronger because when it comes to differences in pay and rank and salary. That's from the collective bargaining unit, item 28.3.
So that again, 5.1.
Five one.
Just cite
28.3.
So 28.3.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Yep.
I have a couple of questions, and this may be that I just don't see where these are, but in the page 202 of your proposal, you say 5A, the mechanism for evaluating sabbaticals is based on the formula of time since last week, merit, and service. And then Chair Ford mentioned that there was a percentage, a higher percentage applies to time since last week then applies to merit. And I was wondering, where are those percentages, or where is that formula in the policy itself? I'm probably just missing it. That's my first question. My second is, on the flowchart, which I think is kind of cool, on the back of the sabbatical policy, at the very bottom of the draft flowchart, it says,
I'm trying to note down your last point, so I want to make sure it didn't get lost. So the percentages, where the percentages specified, I was catching that in the last one. Okay, so, and then the next point was, again?
The question is on the flowchart of the sabbatical policy.
Okay.
The draft flowchart on the left side. At the very bottom, second from the bottom, it says, recommend if funding available.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that our collective bargaining agreement said that we have certain number of sabbaticals that they're not based off the funding's available, because then there would be zero.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, so what that's referring to is that normally we have a minimum number of sabbaticals that are permitted, right, under the amount that's being agreed upon through the collective bargaining. They say there'll be at least a certain percentage of the faculty will get sabbaticals. And so, given that, we know that we're going to have at least as many as that for sabbaticals. There have been some years when the sabbatical pool has been augmented from other sources, right? Whether it's from that same source, just more is coming in this time, or whether someone else could possibly have contributed to that same pool. So in that case, then those would be beyond, say, the first 12, or whatever it happens to be based on the population at the time. We might have more that are meritorious, and they would be recommended, but not ranked as high as those top that we know for sure should be getting them. And so that's what that second category is for, but they continue to be ranked. And then there are others that they say, that, you know, even if we had the money, this application wasn't strong enough to warrant by the time.
I see. So there's really two categories. Recommend are the ones that the recommend parentheses rank refers to the ones who definitely would get it.
Right. Those are those, because if you see in the beginning of the policy, it says we have a minimum that we have to do. So that's why those are ranked, and we know that they're definitely there. Then those that didn't quite make that first set, they're still continuing to be ranked, but they're in the category of it as additional funding. And we're drawing on a policy, you know, those of us who've seen NSF or those kinds of grants are used to seeing this kind of a model where the legislation may add more, people take money away, find their.
Okay, so I'm going to take the next quarter, and then we're at the end of the time for the first reading.
I'm speaking with regards to my constituency, and it might be a moot point, so let me ask a question first. I understand from reading the eligibility that permanent full-time temporary faculty, as we have it, would also be eligible for receiving these funds. Now, there is the question is whether there is a way of addressing the language in such a way that it could be understood that it is not just a pro forma application that somebody would turn in, which then is turned out because so many apply, and in the ranking system one would not be considered because one is hired only for one particular task, namely teaching. So the other criteria, such as research and scholarly and creative activity, unless it is directly related to improved instruction, would not really count. And I mention that because, you know, with all good intentions, but I'm aware of one school that, you know, passed a temporary travel policy that categorically excludes adjunct faculty from receiving travel grants, and then further inquiry comes out, well, it does not violate the spirit of the CBA because we are not supposed to travel anyway. So even though it does not violate the intention of the law, still it changes the understanding of participation in the community as a faculty member, right, based on the employment criteria. So I wonder if any consideration can be given to extend the plain level field for these criteria to each of the applicants, regardless of whether or not they are tenure track or adjunct, as long as they are full-time and with 6-year contract and you know, meet all the other requirements. Or is it then something that once it gets to the level of ranking, it is win-win understood that this will be the lowest ranking case, even though there might be very, impressive reasons why the scholarly work actually is compared to other.
So let me make sure I'm understanding the point. Because lecturers are not expected to be doing university service, they're not paid, you say.
Right.
They wouldn't be putting it in that area, so then they're basically set behind when they come to
and if they were to put it in, the language could be, well, you're putting all that in, but you're not hired for doing that. And I don't know how to work around it, but
it's an interesting conundrum, yes. I your point is safe.
You said that you
have
run this by CFA?
CFA has a representative on FSAC, and we've been consulting with them. They've been seeing this as it's been coming through. So we have been trying to communicate with them. They've been seeing drafts as it's working through, sometimes giving us, because we had a task force that was working on it jointly with URTPS, and then it came back to FSAC, and we talked there and had input from the CFA reps when they were present there, so we have been doing that.
Okay, they have no objection to the drafts?
They have not.
First of all, I'd like to say that this seems like a very exceptionally clear and well-crafted proposal. Second, I'd like to address Chairman of the Board's comments about levels of review, because I do concur with you. Having served on both levels of review, I've seen proposals that range from the meritorious book contract and opportunity to learn or earn a new certification to here on the beach. I've also seen at both levels of review different extent of recommendation from a mere rubber stamp, this looks fine, to a full-blown letter from a department or school or a department chair or school dean in support of a sabbatical application. I think the one thing that this particular draft policy attempts to address is the disparities and uniformity among different schools and different committees in addressing the support level needed for a sabbatical or a lead candidate. Second thing I'd like to say is that, and respond to Senator Nelson and the CFA involvement, is I'm just wondering if we're jumping the gun a little bit here, because is there any whiff of information about a successive contract addressing any changes in sabbatical or leave policy that might render anything that's changed here completely moot?
And the last speaker will be Senator
Ryan.
I'm not a senator.
No,
I'm a guest. So I just wanted to say that we've been I oversaw the review of sabbaticals once this fall. I'm actually on URTP for 3 years, and in one case I couldn't be part of it because I had a sabbatical application. In another case I couldn't because I had a spouse with a sabbatical application. So when we went through this fall, I have to say that there are some disparities among departments and schools as to how much they participate. So the point that you made, Ben, is a really valid one, and I think that the workload issue is pretty significant, because I think, if I recall right, many departments didn't submit it. And in fact, I think maybe the majority did. And school recommendations were also sometimes, mostly just a kind of, yeah, this looks like a good thing. So I can't think of any cases this year where the department recommendation would have turned one way or another. And so really, it's the responsibility of the candidate to write something clear. I saw a sabbatical request that was written within the jargon of the discipline almost failed because, you know, the work was great because the person hadn't tailored it to the general audience. So I've been sitting here trying to think about this and, you know, whether or not this cutting these levels of review is critical to this proposal or not, I don't think it's critical. So we can, you know, think about this, and the objections are really something to consider. But I was trying to think about, well, you know, like Richard said, NSF proposal comes in. Generally, there are specialists reviewing, and then there's non-specialists reviewing. So even there's non-specialists. In this case, we're talking about non-specialists reviewing, so to speak, or at least potentially non-specialists reviewing. Why might that be okay? Well, when I'm thinking about the kinds of things that people are asking to do, we're basically evaluating whether somebody has put together a solid proposal for how they're going to spend the semester. You know, and the elements that make that solid proposal are things like, do they have some kind of agreement with someone that they'll make good progress? Do they have a record of their past leaves producing something as an outcome of that, and so on. And so, you know, we could go either way or not, but in the end, unless every department at school put a similar effort into their evaluation, it kind of ends up being unfair either way. It could be unfair to a candidate if a thin thing comes in from a school. So it's just something to think about.
What is the first reading?
Thank you.
And before I hand back to Gavin, I'm going to move on to the other. Dylan said that some of us are smart enough to work on the beaches.
All right. Thank you. So, Vice President Lopez, tell us a report for us.
Sure. I have a thing to report on. First is. One time that Senator Byrne, in the newspaper article, I wanted to assure you that the students that we were talking about that are under distress for life pressures and these other things, they would indeed be seen by our counseling center. I think the disconnect for us is, what does mandated mean? And who has the authority to actually mandate this? Actually, none of us do. I'm not even as a conduct officer, do I choose not to do it because it's very difficult to get someone to engage in a therapeutic relationship when you're saying you have to be there. So I think the difference is, I as a faculty member or I in my position tell a student, hey, I think you really need to go, and this would be helpful for all those reasons. Those students are definitely. And also, in regards to the alcohol and drug dependence, I think what Dr. Wyatt was trying to say and what I know our practices for treatment is if someone's actually addicted to a substance, they need treatment, which we don't have the services or level of psychological expertise to take someone through a treatment process. So that's why we refer those out. But we see students all the time who make bad decisions after they've consumed alcohol, or if they're thinking, hey, I'm drinking quite a bit now because I've got that really tough course with the president / provost. does that help at all?
It certainly does. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And Dr. White is still available to come and talk to us if should this body decide.
Go ahead. Finish it. I'll take questions.
Okay. Another piece of information is that on Monday I gave the president a thumbnail sketch of what budget cuts for my division might look like. If we were to come up with a first level cuts. In that first cut is taking Summer Bridge budget and cutting that budget in half. And then asking those folks that deliver Summer Bridge, which is our orientation program for EOP, to really look at how can we deliver this program in the best way we possibly can, given the limited resources. They have come up with a plan to try to do that this year, and then have a whole year of planning ahead of them of how do we really start conceptualizing Summer Bridge in a way that melds itself somewhat to orientation. I've asked Dr. Leslie Shelton to start looking at the creation of a first-generation center. We have many grants and other opportunities for these students to, I think, be served differently and in addition to what our EOP counselors do throughout the year and not just Summer Bridge. So it's one of those very difficult and not pleasant decisions that I had to make of how do I present a budget and what preserves jobs and also preserves services. It's not a pleasant decision, but it's what I had to make. And now, for the good news, I would like to announce that Mr. Mark Fabianar signed his paperwork this morning, and he will be starting on March 19th as our director of the Multicultural Center. It's a lot of thanks to Dr. Armagnana and the provost and the rest of the cabinet to keep this position and the funding in very, very difficult times, but the importance that folks saw of this position. Been difficult, but Mark was here this morning signing taking a look at the Multicultural Center and is eager to start. He's run Multicultural Centers at Cal Poly. He's currently a faculty member, adjunct faculty at Sac State, and is teaching four courses. That's why he's starting part-time in March. And as soon as his coursework is finished and grades are in, then he'll be here more full-time. So we'll send out a more formal announcement giving him some more props and accolades there.
Senator Pinkston. Yes, I just wanted to sort of chime in with something Matthew just said. That I worked in the counseling center for 15 years under four different directors, and the policy mandated students or seeing students who were abusing substances has not changed. I want to make sure to vouch for that. I like the way you described the policy.
And Dr. White hasn't reached a consensus set in 2 weeks. She will be here to take more detailed questions. So, Senator Byrne.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate your clarification about the amendment. Very useful. There's one other matter to clarify for me. My understanding is that the student fees were increased by $100. In the fall. Were those fees to be directed to counseling and psychological services specifically?
Yes.
The entirety of those fees?
All those fees go to the counseling psychological services, and then their EO 1000 fees, which ASI pays for. All the different entities, because it went from state side funding to funded, and so the connections to the internet, the space, all that is now rented from the university. So I think if you want a complete budget breakdown, I'd be happy to have Dr. White and us talk about where all those different funds go. Most of it's still in personnel, but the relationship of CAPS changes when it went to fee funded, and that's similar to all fee funded programs.
Okay, I do have another question, but perhaps I should just reserve it for Dr. White.
Any of that conversation you want to have more, Senator Byrne, or if you want to have a meeting, I can try to explain it the best I can. And
sure,
the budget's enormous. Senator
Bass.
I have a question about the new MCC director. The proposal, as I recall, was for a 3-year position. So is it a 3-year position? And does the part-time starting March 19th count as part of the year? How's it actually going to help? What is the actual term that this person is getting?
It's much like a grant-funded position, or much like being an interim vice president. Allegedly, there is funding for the position, and I get a letter every year around August 17th that says, hey, we're going to let you do this again, or where your services are no longer needed. So it's the same. I have the funding within my budget for 3 years for this position. In meeting with the candidate today, since they're only starting part-time now, and then they're going to for a short stint before the new budget year happens.
What I'm going to try to do in the next 3 years is save the equivalent of that. So starting July 1, the person will actually have 3 full years, including this startup. So I'm going to try to do, but as we've all said, the budget is such a fluid thing. We do have some salary savings from positions that are open, but I'm going to try to put that and allow that person to have the maximum time. And we're trying to commit in cabinet and other places to try to find funding for this position.
ASR Senator Tonio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matthew, in regards to the summer bridge, I've been talking to students a little bit who went through the program and who are also part of the summer bridge leaders. And they're concerned that the change in the summer bridge will negatively impact the students' experience, and that perhaps there will be several issues in there that they were concerned about. In any case, I was wondering if this would be possible to have somewhat of a presentation maybe in the AS Senate in regards to Summer Bridge and the thumbnail plan or whatever, as you refer to it as, for the students, so that maybe some of these rumors and concerns that they have might be answered.
I think two places might actually be helpful for that. One is the EOP Club, which actually is specific for EOP students, so that might be a charge that I give to back to the EOP counselors and Bruce, who's the manager, and say, you know, why don't, as you're developing these plans and what it looks like, here's another group that you might want to get some feedback on. So what are those core groups and core things that the students experience that you want to try to preserve as much as you can? And I know that group is also working on a clear set of learning outcomes, and so how do we best match those learning outcomes and the things we really want to are at the core of that program, because we aren't going to be able to deliver it the same way. We'll have to look at ways we can deliver that and see if we can bring more staff to it. So there may be a chance for more stateside staff to come and help at that time to deliver the services, but it's really the experts, two of whom are sitting in the room, to figure out how that program works along with their students to provide, again, the best we can with the resources.
Thank you. So I've just been reminded by the person who operates the recording experience. Talk to the mic. Senator Wilson.
Yeah. You should realize that being able to cut in a program which is designed to improve minority retention, like Summer Bridge, could raise some eyebrows.
I am well aware of that, Senator. I raise more than eyebrows. My raise is a little higher. But when I look at preserving jobs and looking at the limited staff I have and how I don't get in trouble with other folks and make people's jobs undoable, I only have a limited, narrow band of what I have left in student affairs to actually cut. I'd like to have more than one career counselor per 8,000 students. That's a horrible faculty staff student ratio. So there are all those areas, and this is one of them. But I have to say, the EOP students have one of the richest staffing patterns of any program I have, for the number of students they serve and the folks that are there. Would I like to have four more? Sure. So no decision is a good decision at this point. And with the good of bringing the multicultural center director, we have limited resources on this side. And I don't like making that decision, but it's the one I could have with preserving jobs. All right.
And Vice President Rainey, would you like to give a report?
Oh. Thank you. Okay, so on Monday some 10,000 students marched on the Capitol, and we took our box full of bills up there, and the plan was to go deliver it into the Capitol building on Monday. However, the Capitol building was having, some security issues at that point, and so they actually wouldn't let us bring the box in. And so we're going to send it to a couple of campuses that didn't get to have the box the first go-around, and we will bring them back when we do our lobbying visits in April. But overall, the march was very successful. We had a great turnout, some 10,000 students from the community colleges, the CSUs, and the UCs. It was a very successful event. I also wanted to, we touched on it earlier, to extend our gratitude for everybody who came out and participated in the event yesterday. it was a great opportunity, and I think students really appreciated being able to connect with the leaders on campus and put some faces to names and get to ask some questions and be a part of that conversation. So thank you again. The last piece is our student elections are underway. You'll see signs and posters out and about. We're very excited about the candidates who are up for election. And so if you see them, be sure and grill them and make sure they're on the game.
Questions for us? Okay. I had one question. Did somebody count how many bills were in that box?
Our best guess, I think, our best guess was around 10,000 when we were walking around, but people were stuffing them in the box as we were walking around too. So.
And I don't know, but somebody asked you last time, and there's not an intent to compile all those and type them up or anything like that, but I would just suggest that if you could even gather, you know, 50 powerful stories, it would be wise to take pictures of them and, you know, have them available for a slideshow on the website or something like that. It could be a powerful story to tell.
I'll take that back. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
No report. We meet next week. This will be interesting. Chinese sense of the word.
Any questions for Senator Nelson? You want to tell her to take the statewide Senate next week? Okay, so standing committees. Let's see. Okay, who's here?
I am.
Oh, Senator Baldwin made his day, yes.
We met this morning with the provost, and thank him again for spending over an hour with us. Deborah Roberts was elected chair for next year, so thank you, Deborah, for continuing on. Two of the APC subcommittees are currently evaluating one issue, the SSU online course policy, and the other issue is the MOU with the School of Extended Education. So that's ongoing work.
Question for Senator Holm?
I was asked at FSAC today how much AFS was being involved in the online policy discussions, and I couldn't clearly answer. No, at the Academic Freedom Subcommittee. So,
Deborah is chair of that committee. Maybe she can answer.
So far, we sent it to IT.
Right.
All right, and then so
Deborah, we can't hear you. Sorry.
Sorry. So far, we've sent it to IT. So we have a list that we're going down, and I'm just doing one at a time. It's all I can manage.
Got it. But what was implicit in the question that I'll make explicit, I think that several folks would like to make sure that the Academic Freedom Subcommittee is among those that will get to chime in.
I'll make it like a colonoscopy, Richard. Everybody gets to see it.
That's the first for my tenure as chair. Any more questions? All right, Senator Galinsky for EPC.
Gosh, that's a hard act to follow. This meeting is going down the tube. Anyway, that and the other problems on the EPC will not reverse the proposed change to the unqualified but we have passed this morning unanimously provisions to the MS Nursing Family Nurse Practitioner Program, which will come to XCOM the next week. And we've also passed a provision to the Theater Arts Program, the creation of a concentration of theater studies in that program. That will also come to XCOM next week. That's the end of my report.
Any questions for Senator Galinsky? All right. Senator Sankos.
We haven't been doing much lately. You've already been hearing about most of it. But I did want to, on behalf of the Academic Freedom Subcommittee, make sure everybody was aware of the read-in, the Academic Freedom read-in that they're
going to be doing on April 4th and April 18th. These will be in the Academic Affairs Conference Room, Stevenson 1040, from 12:20 to 1 o'clock. Basically, they're taking some time out of their committee, their regular committee meeting time, to work, to basically have a book reading group together with about For the Common Good, Principles of American Academic Freedom by Finkin and Post. So if you're interested in being part of that, I encourage you to look in that direction. And we'll be bringing forward soon some revisions to the conflict of interest policy once we find out what legal language we need to have in there. Some basically requirements are coming down from Washington, D.C. that we need to comply with in order to keep getting NIH grants. So you'll be seeing that come forward sometime in the not too distant future. So I guess that's my report.
Any questions for Senator Sanghas? Okay. Senator Madavi for Student Affairs.
I have two items to share. One is that at last next Senate meeting, you will see the student fee referendum code that we have worked on in collaboration with the advisory committee and associated students. Also, and I'm glad she's here today, Anya Bergman came to our student affairs committee meeting this week, and she's really wonderful at career services. You should talk to her because she'll come and do a seminar in your class. She wants to provide a lot of direct service. And don't cost her maybe today, but there are career services on campus, and she is energetic, and I'm very excited that she's here. So, look for her. And there she is.
Any questions for Senator Madavi? All right. Is there anybody who was tasked with getting a CFA report today? Okay. And Senator Baker, do you have a report?
No report today.
Okay. So, any items for me to go to the order? Yes. Senator Vance?
A couple of things. Well, first, since there was no CFA report, I'd like to just remind you what Chair Ford mentioned at the beginning. On this Monday, from noon till 1:30 in the library in Schultz 3001, remediation as a civil rights issue. And that'll be a very interesting talk, so I encourage everyone to attend. There will be refreshments served. And then this is Women's History Month, and today is International Women's Day. And there's a nice poster that's been put out by ASP Productions. And if you just, on your way out, go through the student union base or bottom floor, stop by ASP. They have these posters, plus a lot of individual posters for several of the events coming up over the rest of the month. Movies, speakers, all kinds of wonderful things. So be sure and get them and post them. And one thing that did get left off of the poster, so I'll just mention, is next Wednesday is the second in the Women in Science lecture series at the library. So next Wednesday will be the Physics Chanteuse, Linda Williams, and she does a media performance, which ought to be very interesting. So she's a media performance artist and a physicist. So that's next Wednesday at noon. And then the final one is a week from that Wednesday with our own Carmen Works in Chemistry and Shona Mukherjee from Biology. So those are Wednesdays at noon in the library. Thank you.
Senator Grant.
Next week is Geek Week at the Science and Technology Clubs. We'll be hosting events. We'll be having competitions. Highlight of the week will be Pi Day, Wednesday, March 14th, when students will be allowed to throw pies at their math professors. So that'll be a new event. Right in front of Darwin. So
it's great. Cost double for faculty.
Yes.
Or maybe a triple for it.
They're free.
They're free to go back. I just used to be great at the universe.
That's what you're paying for big bucks.
Anything more? All right, thank you all. We're here.